previously on Unsolved.
What do you think happened to Alexis?
The best theory is that someone owed a debt, perhaps a drug debt, and they use Alexis as a pawn to maybe try to collect that drug debt. This is total speculation. And they snatched her, and no one knows really what happened after that.
From USA Today and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved Season 4, A Missing Girl, A Search for Truth. I'm Gina Barton. Chapter 3, Where Would She Have Gone? More than a decade after 7-year-old Alexis Patterson disappeared, her biological father, Kenya Campbell, was back in the news.
Kenya Campbell garnered a lot of attention over the last 11 years, the ongoing search for his daughter, Alexis Patterson. Now he is in jail. Jailers are keeping an eye on him after prosecutors maintain he beat a young girl within an inch of her life.
Those child abuse charges are the reason why Kenya Campbell is in prison right now. In the comments posted to the YouTube clip of that story from Channel 4 in Milwaukee, a bunch of people were saying, basically, that since Kenya abused his younger daughter, he must have had something to do with Alexis's disappearance, too. It seems like a logical theory. After all, Kenya Campbell has spent a lot of his life in and out of police custody. He told me he cooperated fully with the police who were searching for his daughter.
So they had told me that they wanted me to give DNA to do a make up a chemical composite to Alexis. No problem. Let's go with it. They wanted me to do a polygraph test. No problem. They asked me if I knew the whereabouts of my daughter. They asked me if I put anybody up for kidnapping my daughter. Things of that nature.
So they were trying to figure out if you knew anything about where she was or how she disappeared.
Exactly. If I had any participation in it, basically, of her business.
And you passed?
With flying colors.
Under Wisconsin state law, the police aren't allowed to talk about polygraphs or their results without written consent from the person tested. Kenya wrote a letter giving the Milwaukee police permission to share his results with me, but they came back and said he needed to fill out a department form in front of a notary, which I'm pretty sure they know is nearly impossible for someone in prison, and it's not required under the law. I've informed them of this, but as I'm recording today, I haven't heard back, so I couldn't confirm what Kenya said. But I do know the police quickly concluded it was impossible that he had taken Alexis. His alibi was as solid as they come. On the day his daughter vanished, Kenya Campbell was in jail. Even though Kenya says the police asked him about the possibility that Alexis had been kidnapped, that wasn't their leading theory. At a media briefing 3 days after Alexis failed to come home from school, the Milwaukee police chief, Arthur Jones, told reporters he believed she had run away. I cannot find any audio or video recordings of that briefing. But I did find an Associated Press article. It was published on May 6, 2002, and it quoted Jones as saying things did not go well with her mother that morning, and investigators believed Alexis intentionally did not go to school. The story also quotes Chief Jones as saying, "We have no suspect because we have no reason to believe right now that a crime has been committed." I have tried to reach Chief Jones, who has been retired since 2003 and now lives in Georgia. He hasn't returned my calls or emails. From what I can tell, the police came up with the theory that Alexis ran away after her mom, Ayanna Patterson, told them about an argument over some cupcakes. At the time, Ayanna was married to LeBron Bourgeois, who I told you about in episode 2. More than 20 years later, Ayanna is still angry that the police made such a big deal out of the cupcakes. In her view, it was a minor disagreement, the type of thing that happens between parents and kids all the time. I asked her to tell me about it.
Thursday is when, which was May 2nd, is when we went to Jewel Osco on 36th and North Avenue to get the cupcakes, because I thought her cupcake day, her snack day was on Friday. She picked her cupcakes out, okay? We went home. The next morning when it was time for me to sign her homework, she hadn't done it. So before she walked out the door, I asked her. I said, big girl, let me see your work. She didn't want to show it to me because she knew she hadn't done it. So when she showed it to me, I said, no, you're not taking your cupcakes to school because I can't sign it. Of course she was upset. She was upset. So my ex-husband, LaRon, he tried to sneak her the cupcakes. I said, no, she's not getting the cupcakes.
So when the police said, oh, she probably ran away, what was your reaction to that?
I said, I told the police my daughter didn't run away. I had a real issue with that. She's 7 years old.
Natalie Wilson is the co-founder of the Black and Missing Foundation, a nonprofit that supports families of color whose loved ones disappear. She told me a lot of officers have an unconscious bias when it comes to Black children.
To know that a seven-year-old is missing and to say that she ran away, her mind isn't even developed. So that tells me you are treating her that she left voluntarily as an adult. She is not an adult. Your mind typically doesn't fully develop until you're around 21 years old, according to research. So where would she have gone?
More after the break. Hey, everybody. I wanted to take a minute to tell you about my friend, Meg Jones. Meg was a general assignment reporter, which meant she covered everything. Everyone in the newsroom loved her, including my reporting partner on Unsolved, Ashley Luthern.
Meg Jones embodied everything that a good journalist is. She was kind, compassionate, and caring, but above all, she was curious.
Meg's specialty was the military and veterans affairs, and she took 8 different trips to Iraq and Afghanistan. Meg was a proud graduate of the University of Wisconsin. In 2018, she did a video about the college's fight song on Wisconsin.
You know, it's I'm hardwired into it. And I got my thinking is that if I live to be 95 years old and I get dementia or Alzheimer's or something like that, and I forget my name and I forget everything, I have a feeling that on Wisconsin still it's always going to be up there.
Meg was only 58 when she died of pancreatic cancer in December of 2020. I'm telling you about Meg today because I'm hoping you'll join me in honoring her by contributing to a scholarship in her name. If you'd like to make a donation, please visit megjonesfund.org. And thank you. Now, a lot of you may be thinking, well, those cops in Milwaukee must be out of touch for calling a young kid a runaway. Or maybe you're thinking things must have changed over the past 20 years. Unfortunately, if you're thinking that, you're wrong. In addition to reporting for this podcast over the past year, I've been working on a project for USA Today, where I was hired in 2021 as an investigative reporter. I've been working with a lot of colleagues here and around the USA Today network, which has papers all over the country. And we've uncovered some pretty troubling practices when it comes to police investigations into missing kids. The first thing I want to talk about is the word runaway and how that label affects what the police do. My fellow reporters and I looked at the rules for missing children's investigations in more than 50 jurisdictions around the country. In 40% of them, police put less effort into finding runaways than they do for other missing children. For example, runaways don't get Amber Alerts. You know, those bulletins on billboards and phones that inform the public about kids who have disappeared. According to the experts at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, a nonprofit dedicated to finding missing kids, calling someone a runaway can imply they're not in danger, when in truth, they often are. Angeline Hartman is the center's media director.
A lot of times people misunderstand that a child has, when a child has left their situation, that would voluntarily left, that means that that child ran away, right? Was that child actually lured away? Is that child going to meet somebody and what meant to come back 10 minutes later? You know, all there are lots of things that happen when a child is supposedly under the term runaway.
In 2012, the center redesigned its posters to remove labels such as runaway and family abduction because of the judgments people make when they hear those words.
But now we're clear every child is labeled as missing.
Right.
And for us, that's the most important thing. It does not matter what kind of case this is behind this child, what the circumstances are. We're talking about a missing child. And so when we're talking about a missing child, that's something that everybody should pay attention to.
For the same reason, law enforcement agencies in Wisconsin now use the term voluntary missing instead of runaway, a Milwaukee police spokesman told us. He said they made the change because a lot of people associate running away with attention seeking and problematic behavior. But dozens of departments around the country still use the term, and advocates believe it's used more often with Black children. Gaetan Borders is the president and CEO of Peas in Their Pods, a nonprofit that aims to give voice to missing children of color and their families. She says that Black children, even those as young as Alexis was, are often adultified by law enforcement, meaning they're treated as more mature than they actually are.
But the go-to is, they'll be back. They're out there. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, adultifying them or sexualizing them. They're fine. They'll be okay. So it's not the same response where if it were a white kid, you know, a girl, particularly a damsel in distress, they need help. Like everything stops. Let's help them because they're out here in this cruel world and they can't handle it. Mm-hmm. And they need help. But for children of color, it's, you know, they're okay. They're out there on the streets. You know, that's what they do. They'll be back.
James Causey, a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel columnist who covered the case at the time, thinks that definitely could have happened in Alexis's case. James grew up in the city and attended Milwaukee public schools. He got his first internship while he was still in high school and has worked for the paper ever since. He still lives in town, not far from the neighborhood where Alexis disappeared. He doesn't necessarily blame Arthur Jones, who was Milwaukee's first Black police chief, or any individual officer for the flaws in the investigation. Instead, he believes the city's long tradition of racism has impacted its policing.
I think our kids are treated a little bit differently because our kids are not valued by institutions the way that they should be. You know, like, would she run away? You know, what else could be in the background to cause her to go missing? You know what I mean? And those kind of factors probably don't come up when it's a white kid.
In those early days, the police didn't have any solid evidence of what happened to Alexis. They had received a lot of conflicting information. In fact, the initial police report said Alexis had been seen walking near her home at 2:40 p.m. the day she disappeared. A Milwaukee police spokesman recently told me that information had been provided by, quote, a juvenile student, end quote, and it was investigated but not substantiated. James remembers hearing all kinds of different stories. Some kids said they saw Alexis crying on the school playground that morning, and others said they saw her that afternoon. A few days before Alexis disappeared, Ayanna says she called her teacher, Deborah Ruland, to make sure Alexis had been going inside for the breakfast program before school instead of just hanging out on the playground until class started.
So her teacher, Miss Ruland, told me that Alexis have not been going into breakfast and she's been in the back of the building talking to an unknown lady all the way in the back of the building where no one can see her.
Ayanna says she asked Alexis who the lady was and what they were talking about.
I asked her. She said nothing. The lady was just like really nice. And then 2 days later, her teacher, Miss Ruland, called me And she told me that Alexis was in the back of the building talking to the same lady, the exact same lady. And the lady didn't drop anyone off. She didn't pick nobody up. And she didn't. She said, I'd never seen this lady in my life, Ayanna. This is what Miss Rulon said. So when Alexis came home, I got on Alexis' behind about that. That's when she got in trouble.
Ayanna says that argument was a lot more serious than the one about the cupcakes. Yet, Alexis didn't try to run away or skip school after it happened. I tried to confirm this with Miss Ruland, but she was reluctant to talk. I spoke briefly with her twice. The first time was on the phone. She was driving when I called and asked me to send her an email with my questions. I did, but she never replied. The second time was during an event to mark the 20th anniversary of Alexis's disappearance, where she said a few words to the crowd of about 100 people.
I'm retired now, but even today, students will see me, and they'll say, what about Alexis, Ms. Ruland? What about Alexis? And all of our children still have Alexis in their heart. And so it's in God's hands, and I believe there's always hope. There's always hope that she's somewhere, and someday we're going to find Alexis.
Later that evening, I introduced myself to Miss Ruland and reminded her about my earlier call. We talked about this project and about her work with victims of human trafficking. She agreed to do an interview, and I told her I would call to set it up. But then she ghosted me. That was extremely frustrating because I wanted to hear what Miss Ruland had to say about the lady who had allegedly been talking to Alexis behind the school. I also wanted to ask Miss Ruland about something else Ayanna told me.
2 weeks before Alexis' disappearance, Highmount Elementary School sent a letter home to the parents. Every parent at the school letting us know that there was a man trying to abduct a child at the school. And for us to watch our children and to make sure that our children were safe. They said it was a red truck had been outside Alexis' school. After Alexis was gone, after my daughter disappeared, the truck wasn't out there anymore. They never seen this truck ever again.
James Causey remembers hearing about both of those things. And he thinks the police should have taken them more seriously.
There were some people who said that they saw, like a week before Alexis was taken, that there was this red truck that tried to take a young kid from a playground. That played a factor. The fact that some kids said that they saw an older woman talking to Alexis on the playground. And none of this stuff was like taken, like that should have been like immediate. That should have drawn a lot of attention right then and there. And I don't know why it didn't to the level that it should have.
Remember, it wasn't just some kids who said they had seen the woman on the playground. Ayanna says Miss Ruland saw it too. I asked the current Milwaukee police chief, Jeffrey Norman, whether the department had received information about the lady behind the school or the attempted abduction of a child by a man in a red truck. He said he didn't remember. Norman wasn't the chief at the time. He was a new detective. But he allowed Inspector Paul Lau to talk with Ashley and me a few weeks later. Inspector Lau was a uniformed officer when Alexis disappeared. But now, he oversees the cold case unit, so he has more recent knowledge about Alexis's case.
So a couple of things that I've been hearing about. One is that the school had sent out a letter to the parents saying that there was some suspicious person talking to kids at the school. And then there was another report that there was a truck kind of in the vicinity or maybe seen speeding away from the school at some point. Like, do you remember any of that? Or
I do not
shed some light on any of that?
I apologize. I don't remember any of that. And that very well may be true or in the files.
When I got in touch with the public information officer, he emailed this answer. The Milwaukee Police Department followed up on all tips provided by citizens and media. Some of those tips led to a dead end or were not related to the missing person investigation. We still encourage citizens and our partners to continue to forward leads to help bring closure to this case. I didn't have any luck getting anyone from the Milwaukee Public Schools to answer those questions either. So, as I waited for the police department to turn over the records they had promised, I was on my own trying to figure out who these suspects were, or if they even existed. We'll have more after the break. Without any files to go on, I was left with Google. Alexis Patterson's case has gotten quite a bit of publicity from the Journal Sentinel and from local Milwaukee TV stations through the years. There wasn't anything in those results that I didn't already know. About 10 pages into the search results, I ended up on Reddit. Obviously, as a journalist, I can't take an anonymous Reddit post at face value. But I thought a couple of the theories there were worth following up on. Someone on a missing persons subreddit said that Alexis was one of the people Israel Keyes looked up on his computer. As it turns out, Israel Keyes was a serial killer. The FBI usually doesn't publicize information about its cases. For season one of this podcast, I asked the Bureau for its records about a serial killer who may have murdered John Zara, and it took 6 years to receive them. Israel Keyes was different. He had been talking to the FBI, and the things he said led them to believe that he had killed 11 people. But he didn't give up all the names before he killed himself in jail in 2013. So the Bureau decided to see if publicity would help. They posted a bunch of records and videos from the Keyes case on their website, along with this audio.
The FBI releases interviews and a timeline of events of confessed serial killer Israel Keyes in hopes of identifying his homicide victims. I'm Molly Halpern of the Bureau, and this is Wanted by the FBI. Investigators say Israel Keyes, who took his own life in jail, committed 11 homicides across the country between 2001 and 2012. Case agent Jolene Godin says investigators have identified three victims.
It's really important to us to be able to bring some type of closure to family members that are still wondering what happened to their loved ones.
Keyes also admitted to multiple kidnappings, bank robberies, home invasions, and arsons. He told investigators he buried caches of money, tools, and weapons across the country to help him commit his crimes.
Our primary concern is identifying additional homicide victims, but we're certainly also interested in identifying other crimes that he committed because it will help us put him in a particular place in the country.
He's told FBI agents he related the most with convicted serial killer Ted Bundy.
He didn't really have remorse. He didn't have empathy.
I dug through all the videos and documents on the FBI's site, but didn't come up with anything about the missing people Keyes had supposedly searched on his computer. So it was back to the Google drawing board. I followed a series of links to find a podcast called True Crime Bullshit, which is pretty much all about Israel Keyes. The title of the show comes from a statement Keyes made to the FBI that he didn't want his case to get a lot of media attention. The creator and host of the show, Josh Hallmark, was the first to report the names of the people who Keyes had pulled up on his computer. And he pulled them up from an online database called the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, otherwise known as NAMIS. There were 45 of them, and one was Alexis. Josh had a lot more luck getting records from the FBI in a timely manner than I ever did. To make a long story short, a writer who was working on a book about Keyes had sued to get more records than the ones the FBI had posted online, and she won in court. After that case ended, Josh was able to get the same records in a few weeks under the Federal Freedom of Information Act, FOIA for short. The downside was that the Bureau still charged Josh thousands of dollars, which they are allowed to do under the law. Josh raised the money through crowdfunding. Once he got the records, he had to do some of his own reporting to figure out which profiles of missing people Keyes had looked at. Here's Josh.
After he was arrested, the FBI went through his laptop and his girlfriend's computer, her desktop computer, and basically ran images from the internet caches off of those computer against images on the NAMIS database, which is a database of missing people. And there were 45 matches. And So when I FOIA'd the case files from the FBI, you know, they had a list of basically file names and then their corresponding NamUs ID. And so we went through each of those IDs and determined who had been on his computer, whose case he was reading about or looking at.
Josh also learned a couple of other things that made me wonder if Keyes was involved in Alexis's disappearance.
He traveled the country, and he would often plan his crimes years in advance. He would bury kill kits all over the country and then use them years later in the commission of his abductions and murders. So the purpose of the kill kit was to have everything he would need to abduct, rape, murder, bury someone, basically in all of the areas that he traveled frequently. And he would include in them anchors to submerge bodies, which he made out of quick concrete and milk jugs. He would put in tape, condoms, Drano, weapons, money that he stole. We believe that he also would then take the trophies from his kills and put them back in the kill kits afterwards. And they, I guess the other reason he had them is so he could buy supplies for murders years in advance. And then, you know, if they did pulled transactions or like looked at Walmart around the time a couple disappeared, there wouldn't be anything in his name because he would have bought the supplies years in advance. We recently found out that he did have a kill kit in Wisconsin.
Josh also confirmed that Keyes drove a red truck. So, a known serial killer, Israel Keyes, looked at Alexis's missing poster on his computer. He had a kill kit in Wisconsin, where Alexis went missing. And he drove a red truck, the type of vehicle witnesses had reportedly seen during an attempted abduction at Alexis's school a few weeks before she vanished. But Josh Hallmark, the expert on all things Israel Keyes, doesn't think Alexis was one of his victims.
You know, I wrote this case off almost immediately because Keyes said after he had his own daughter, he couldn't just target kids anymore. He couldn't stomach it. And this case was about a year after his daughter was born. So it falls pretty squarely in there. Also, he, for the most part, avoided major cities. And so I can't see him, particularly at this stage in his, for lack of a better word, career. He was trolling wooded areas and parks and just places where it's more common for people to go missing, you know, missing hikers or boating accidents, stuff like that. So at that stage, I just don't see him going in broad daylight to a school in a major city to abduct a child. It goes against everything we know about his MO.
Josh says there's another explanation for why Alexis's poster came up in the FBI search of Keyes's computer. And it was revealed when the FBI agents questioned Keyes.
He said that he never wanted to, at least on his personal computers, Google or search one of his victims by name. So he would search dates and locations. And that actually, when you look at the NamUs 45 through that lens, you get a very clear picture of like who he was looking for or what areas he was looking for.
So it's likely, Josh said, that Keyes killed someone else on May 3rd, 2002. And when he Googled that date and the word missing, Alexis's information came up. So far, Josh hasn't been able to pry loose from law enforcement specifically where in Wisconsin Keyes left a kill kit. But Josh said he'd be surprised if it was near Milwaukee.
I think it's way more likely that it would have been in western Wisconsin, where it's a bit more rural.
Keyes' red truck also didn't quite fit with what we know about the truck spotted near Alexis's school.
He did have a red truck. It was a vintage truck. We know he had access to it in 1997. He moved to New York in 1998, enlisted in the military that year. Traveled extensively, ended up moving back to Washington State. And I think it's highly unlikely that that truck went with him after 1998. So I don't think, you know, we can't find the records on it, but we do have records of him owning other vehicles between 98 and 2002. So it seems highly unlikely he still had the truck at that time. And I know the red truck in the Patterson case was older, but I don't think it was like 60s or 70s. That seems to be way more identifiable and stands out a lot more. So I feel like people would have noted that in eyewitness testimony.
So, when it comes to Alexis's case, Israel Keyes was a dead end. But that wasn't the end of the road for the red truck. Back on Reddit, I found something else. Someone who said she knew about the red truck. I tracked this woman down and asked her to read her post for me.
I believe I know who's red truck, and law enforcement laughed at me. I think we can find Alexis. How come a picture of the red truck was never in the news? Even after there was an eyewitness, makes it even more agonizing. P.S. In 2005, the suspect was arrested for an attempted abduction in South Dakota, still in his old red truck, and sentenced to 80 years. He was later given the death penalty for a murder that took place during an escape attempt. Let's see that in the news. He has ties to Milwaukee, too.
Well, I don't know if you'll ever see it in the news, but you'll hear about it in our next episode. Unsolved is written and produced by me, Gina Barton. Ashley Luthern of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel assisted with reporting this season. Our sound engineer is Bill Schultz. Editors are Amy Pyle and Greg Borowski. Our theme music was composed by Evan Johnson. The TV news clips you heard in this episode came from TMJ4 News, Milwaukee. You can check out True Crime Bullshit, Josh Hallmark's podcast about all things Israel Keyes, on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen. For more on Alexis's case or to sign up for our newsletter, visit usatoday.com/unsolved. My team's investigation on disparities in missing children's cases can be found at missing.usatoday.com.